CliffCentral.com.
Alrighty, are we ready to talk to Costa about his interesting life story? I am Costa. He's put out a book, From Meth to Marathons, and here he is. Having lived as a Greek boy, Costa Karastavrakis.
No, let him say it.
He'll sit down and tell us your name. Dude. What's happening, Costa?
How do we say your name, young man?
Karastavrakis.
You say it so well. I was driving here listening to you.
I've just got to look at it every time I say it. It is long.
And Sia, you got my full name right, too.
Konstantinos. Very good.
Theologos is the middle name.
Wow. Bro? That's a good...
You can't become more Greek than that.
Theologos, if you break it down, means the word of God.
Exactly.
That's very impressive. All right, so first of all, dude, well done on the book. I am Costa. It's been out for a while. And it's a very, very cool story. It's basically your story, which I've heard tangentially. I managed to read a manuscript when you first started putting it down about this journey of yours, which is extraordinary, through crystal meth and your whole life falling apart. I mean, you started off as a, you know, a happy little kid. You had kind of a, you know, like any kid, you had this life where you came from a Greek family and you sort of thought you belonged here and then you thought you belonged there, and somehow you ended up, like so many kids in the world, you ended up in a situation later on, not during your childhood, but where drugs entered your life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm giving the synopsis here, but the most exciting part of this story for me is how you managed to pull yourself out of that, which is something very few people manage to get right, because, you know, most of it ends in tears and ends, which is sad. Mm. And now you're this fitness fanatic. And you come in here and you're running marathons, making it very difficult for the rest of us to be lazy. So take us through the journey and tell me why you had this compulsion to write it down.
The journey started with school. And school was where I remember a lot of bullying taking place. And bullying is an insidious thing. It's something that switched me off as a person. I learned how to dull myself down, because being who I was, while it was normal at home, wasn't something I could feel comfortable with being at school.
But what kind of bullying are we talking about here?
I was calling names. I was the girly boy. Okay. I was also the odd one, the Greek one, the dark one, the skinny one.
Yeah.
And school can always, you know, isolate you for being something different. Now, while I was supported at home, at school I got some messaging, and I took on some incorrect messaging that it wasn't okay to be that way anywhere, because it's so aggressive at school, especially for a 6-year-old. Come on, you know. And then through life, I just kind of got other messaging. Remember, it was the 80s. I was growing up all around. It was not okay to be gay. It was not okay to be this. It was not okay to be that. And you kind of take on this messaging incorrectly. So in my head, and I found a little escape. Started drinking at 12 or twice.
12 is early. I mean, just hang on a second, because I want to dwell on this bullying thing for a moment. There are people, I don't agree with them, but there are people who say that a little bit of bullying is character building. And for some kids, it can be tremendously instructive, because it gives them motivation to prove those people wrong, also to grow their character, to not necessarily care about what other people think. But it can affect some people very badly. And the problem is that we must rather risk not affecting those who could be affected badly by trying to eliminate bullying, than take the possibility that someone will be able to handle it and it could end up, you know, motivating them for various reasons. I mean, Elon Musk famously said he was bullied horribly at school, hated going to school, hated as a result much of his life in South Africa, and wanted to start again in America. But it has, for better or for worse, been part of what's turned him into this monster of modern technology and this incredibly advanced entrepreneur. And I don't know whether that might have happened if he didn't get bullied, and we can only hope that the better angels of our nature would prevail, and that humans, if we were allowed to be nice to each other, would be nice to each other. But kids are mean. And some of bullying is not completely well understood. We always imagine that the kid who's being bullied would have been better off if they weren't bullied, but we don't know for a fact, because that's just what there is.
I know for a fact my being bullied has taught me resilience. I sit down now and I try and understand where my resilience comes from. And I remember it being a huge thing at age 7, 8, 9 years old, having to go back into the school environment. Every day you need to suit up and armor up and go back in there. And that did teach me resilience, something that I tap into right now. So while I'm not saying bullying was entirely bad, you know, I do think there weren't any anti-bullying tools that I had back, that you have now, that I could have had back then.
You were alone in the wilderness.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that aloneness is what got me confused, is something that, you know, maybe I had a predisposition for addiction, but it definitely something that wanted me to zone out from those feelings. I like saying I'm allergic. Back then I was allergic to my feelings. And the feelings it brought up for me were stuff I wanted to escape from. Had there been more tools, perhaps I would have said, okay, I'm being bullied, but I can perhaps handle it. There's other ways of handling it. Perhaps I could have started sport earlier. Fighting back is important for kids. I just didn't find the tools necessary. And worse, I didn't go home and ask for the help because I thought this was something that perhaps was wrong everywhere.
So how did you start drinking at 12, and where do you go to drink at 12?
It was a bar mitzvah, friend's bar mitzvah.
Oh, okay.
Sparkling wine was being handed out, and the first glass tasted really nice. And
who would have known that bar mitzvahs could be the gateway?
Right?
You know? So, okay.
And then 4 glasses later, I was blind drunk. And I remember distinctly enjoying the feeling. I knew it. Took a couple of months before I had another drink, but I had found something that felt nice.
And then you would chase it down, right?
It wasn't, because you might have got caught, so it wasn't something you sat and enjoyed. Famously, like I tell other people, I taught my cousins how to drink. So then I had company, and then we had a reason.
But, I mean, South Africans as a whole, we have a huge drinking culture in this country. Mm-hmm. We, you know, our parents and we drink, and around our children.
It's totally socially acceptable.
It's a very socially acceptable thing. It may be difficult to get hold of the alcohol, but we don't see it as that kind of terrible thing. You know, you're like, I needed my cousins to drink with, because like that's what you see it as. Mm. Drinking is about company.
Social,
it's about people around you, and it's fun.
Oh yeah, Trivarsity. I mean, there I was a high functioning drunk. I was either working or drunk. Super easy to be an alcoholic at Varsity. Even at work, my first job.
Did you go to Rhodes?
Well, yeah, I've heard they're bad enough. Trust me, UCT was bad enough. But at my first job, I was told I'm not spending enough time in the company pub, you know, to raise your profile.
But hang on a second. I just want to just go back a little bit, because you're talking here about being at UCT, you're being a high-functioning alcoholic in your first job, all that kind of thing. So you're not an unsuccessful person during this period from 12, where you start drinking, until you get to adulthood. You're getting things done. And this is what's scary, is a lot of people think, oh, well, your life just spirals out of control. You can immediately pick up there's something wrong here. This guy becomes a loser. That's not what was happening.
No. I had an incredible drive to do well. I wanted a lot for my life. I come from a family of ambitious people. Mm-hmm. It was all around me. I was inspired by that. It was a great time to be alive, you know, the early to mid-90s. I decided to start my own business. South Africa was changing. And, yeah, it was something I wanted. I wanted to do well with my life, but I operated on two levels. My internal world was full of torment and pain and addiction. And externally, things were, because of my will, my drive, things were good, but it was very difficult eventually to sustain that drive with only alcohol, and then I needed more.
So, you know, you talk about the two worlds that you lived in, right? Do you think that part of that duality is what drove you more and more into the substance abuse and kind of hiding in that place?
Yes, hiding the other world, hiding the fact that I was gay, that I perhaps had underlying depression, that I felt less than, that I wasn't normal, that hidden world is what I felt was a big part of, you know, needing some substances to dull out the pain, dull out the abnormal.
So you do a lot of work now with people around just sharing your story, but also kind of trying to help people as performance motivational speaker and all of that. Do you speak to a lot of people who also feel that way? It may not necessarily be hiding their sexuality, but some kind of hidden shame is one of the things that tends to drive people into addicted. That underworld.
Well, there's a famous guy, Gabor Mate, who talks about addiction being shame-based. And the neural network, the setup is pretty similar, that most addictions are born of shame. And most shame is perpetuated by being other than. So I love the way Pabi Moloi gave me a quote talking about othering. Mm. And othering is a big cause for me. So yes, a lot of people can access my story by just knowing that they also felt different. But that, you know, feeling different is okay, but feeling different and feeling bad about it is where it gets dangerous.
Yeah, I wonder if there isn't something we can teach kids at an early age about how being individuals much more important than fitting in. It's such a healthy thing. You know, the whole point of Western philosophy until the Enlightenment and following that more so was that the individual is sovereign and that you are special because you're different and because you exist as an individual. And it doesn't matter what groups you belong to, actually. I think it's a very powerful thing, and if kids can learn that early on, especially if you are an only child or any of those things that tend to make people feel like they need to belong a lot of the time, if you give a kid the impression that it's absolutely fine to be you and that you have complete control over your destiny and all of those kinds of things, and that your determinations aren't made by where you're born or who you belong to or how much you have or any of that stuff, it'll hopefully make kids a little bit more sure of themselves as they enter the world of adulthood.
You know, funny, writing this book, I took it to my publisher and the first iteration of it, they came back and they said, we need a rewrite. We love it, but we need a rewrite. And I was like, oh gosh, here we go. All right, I'll rewrite it. What do you need? And they said, we want more of this othering. We want more of that. Even in writing the book, I was still hiding these differences that they felt, they said, need to be celebrated more. Tell us more about the Greek. Tell us more about the gay. Tell us more about all this othering that makes you unique. So even now in adult life, I, like you say, this individuality, something that even now, just unconsciously, I'm trying to just not portray as my asset.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've been conditioned.
Yeah.
Like we all are conditioned to some degree to fit in. And that's a disease on its own. Like this need to belong. Mm. It's such a... It can be pernicious. It makes you do things that you don't want to do. It makes you say things that you don't want to say. It makes you try things that you shouldn't try. Right?
Yep.
So, I mean, I think we talk a lot more now about mental stability, mental health. We talk a lot more about it because it's so much more acceptable to speak about it. We talk about depression with social media and all of those things. Mm. I'm fascinated to know what it is that escalated your addiction. So you're a high-functioning alcoholic, mm-hmm. but something switches for you and escalates you into other substances.
So it's a combination of trauma, and trauma can come from an abusive relationship. For me, that was one of the reasons. The other reason was a victim of violent crime, two, in fact. And
what happened?
Well, in 1992, I was hijacked on UCT campus and taken along by my hijackers. And dropped outside 20 minutes later outside Khayelitsha. So that kind of kidnap environment, I mean, it's harrowing, but it just ramped up the drinking more. In 1997, I was raped at gunpoint by a policeman.
Jesus.
And that traumatically you know, it was 97. I mean, there was no legal definition in South Africa of male rape. So reporting it was an issue. The shame around it was huge.
The policemen.
Never mind. Taking on the police force, and you know, and then one day the pain gets big enough, or me not looking at the pain is too difficult. Mm. That I was offered hard drugs in my early 30s, and I knew all the warnings. As a high functioning individual, intelligent, I know what it can do. It was a no brainer. I was ready. And I said something that most addicts say when they try their first drug of choice, was like, where have you been all my life? It was like, this is it, I have found it. And I knew that first time I tried it, I was like, this is it, I want this. Like the first time I had a cigarette, that feeling was, aha. And then the neural pathway just lit up and said, I'm home.
Well, you feel it that strongly, huh?
Yep. That's what it was for me. And I remember the next morning I phoned a friend and I said, we have a problem. I like it too much. I knew it straight away.
Wow. That's hectic, man. It's really scary. And crystal meth?
That came 2 years later. I started using my early 30s.
So that's the stuff that you actually, you like cook it in a little pipe, right?
You can, yes.
How did you take it?
I actually took it up the nose.
Like cocaine?
Like cocaine. It's like a shard of glass that damages your
must
head.
It must be sore, but what does it do? I honestly don't know. I've never tried crystal meth. I would tell you if I had, but I'm curious as to what its effect is.
The way I describe it is you hand over all your responsibility in life and everything to something that tells you it's all going to be okay. And like that kind of feeling is it bordered on spiritual.
That sounds religious.
It bordered on spiritual. Like I said once, crystal meth's got this. I've got this. Just give it all over. Hand it all over. I'm taking you along for the ride, and the ride is glorious. The first few times.
Really?
Yep.
Does it take you like? You feel like you're in another world.
You feel like you're in another world, but mostly that everything is okay.
Okay, so it's sorting out for you that gnawing feeling of not belonging. Mm-hmm. It's sorting out that gnawing feeling of not being good enough.
Pain.
It's taking away the pain of these traumatic events that you went through.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're like, well, this is how it feels to feel good. Good Lord. Okay, that's hard to turn away from.
And but then it lies to you, because very soon thereafter the downer is one of the reasons I stopped, because you've never felt something so painful in your life as that, is not that craving for more, but that just wanting the feeling to go away. And the downer is riddled with guilt and pain. And
how does that work?
So it's a spiral.
Yeah, I mean, you just pray constantly that the down is going to go away. Please leave me, please leave me. 2 or 3 days later, we called it Steak Knife Tuesday, you know, because after Sunday not stopping, by Tuesday you want to actually kill yourself.
Boy.
You feel that guilty, that, that's horrible. And my downfall came very quickly. So crystal meth, I'm grateful for bringing me to my knees very quickly.
What's very quickly?
It was a couple of months.
And what does it mean? Like you give up on life, you become a disaster, you start losing money, you start hemorrhaging friends. What happens?
It happened for me over a few months. I'd been using hard drugs on and off, well, more on than off, for 3 years.
How old are you at this stage?
I'm 33.
Okay, so you're 33. You're taking a lot of this stuff.
A lot of the stuff, using my own money. I had.
And how expensive is this habit?
It's not. Drugs are not what's expensive. It's the lifestyle around the drugs and what you do when you're on the drugs that is expensive. You ding your car. You lose your phone. You cut yourself and have to go to hospital. Like all those things that happen around it. Or you make a stupid decision to go to the Durban July and you pay for all your friends. That's what costs money,
sure.
More so than the drugs. But I was 33, spiritually like bankrupt, physically not looking great, mentally just messy, because the crystal meth, takes over. And I was seeing things that weren't even there. I was making stuff up. I was looking out the window at cop cars driving past that weren't even there. So that downfall came when I call it like almost a possession of my firstly my brain, my mind, and obviously my spirit. I felt possessed by this crystal meth.
So, Costa, you're describing a downfall from a pretty higher place.
Mm.
And what we see a lot more of in South Africa is we see people who are starting at rock bottom and falling into a very deep hole around, particularly with crystal meth, because it's so prevalent in our society now. What is it that bottom allowed you to find, and who was there to help, to hold out a hand to help you up?
That bottom was a place of desperation and blind fear. And that fear, like as a horror show, is what turned me away from it. You know, fear, they say fear and desperation should never be a motivator. For me, it's my primary motivator. The fear of that last day of using and the desperation I was in. I never want to go back there again. So, and it's a fantastic thing because it's a great motivating force. And it's one I remind myself of every day because it actually it motivates me to be who I am today, which I'll take. You know, if fear and desperation get you this far in life, then I'll take it.
Almost like you told me the bullying earlier was a motivator
that point. So it is a motivator for me now in
all
a positive
these negative
way.
Motivators you've had.
But if they move me in such a direction, like I say, I'll take them.
Yeah.
But the crystal meth feeling it was the primary motivator, that downer. But who was there for me? A miracle moment. It's a spiritual moment. It's an awakening of some sort that happens. And who was there for me were my friends and family. And the community of other addicts, who are trying to stop using. Mm. So other recovering addicts, their assistance is without parallel.
So is there any way, you know, you're talking a lot about your negative motivators that are all internal. And I think a lot of people who've been affected by drugs in terms of seeing loved ones, seeing friends, family, go down that rabbit hole, are trying desperately to pull them out. Is there any way that a person on the outside can help, or is it all an inside job? You've got to do it yourself.
Well, again, I think Abu Mater says the opposite of addiction is connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, they've done those experiments on rats and mice,
yep,
where they put them into a social situation. The more socially stimulated the rats and mice are, the less prone they are to drink the water that's laced with drugs. If they are isolated and alone and do not have any connection, then they look for that drug and it becomes pathological.
Judgment is not what addicts need.
So in other words, does not help for me to say, ugh, you're a drug addict, get out of my way. I can't be seen with you. I can't have anything to do with you. You're a disaster. No help.
I know what we should be saying is, I know you've used drugs. I know you're high. No. I'm not giving you money. Here's some water. Here's a hug.
No.
I'm not giving you money. I'm not letting you stay the night. I'm not letting you steal from me, but I'm always here.
No. Wow.
A big difference to, I'm kicking you out. You are nothing to me.
And did you get that kind of support from family, from friends?
Oh, absolutely.
You did?
Absolutely, yeah. I was very, very lucky. But one thing I also did is I put the locus of control around myself.
Halala. Locus of control.
All right, explain
that's a
that.
New term.
just explain it to people who might not have any idea of what that means.
It was all me. It was
accountability.
It was my mess. It was mine to clean up.
Hmm.
In fact, my parents didn't know I had used drugs. I hid it from them for many years. So I made a decision to tell them once I only got 6 months clean. Because I didn't want to tell them, oh, I stopped using drugs last week, you didn't know about it, it was hectic. I wanted to get some time behind me because it was my mess, it was mine to clean up. That's the locus of control.
Mm. Sure. All right, Costa. So then you become addicted to marathons. Now, this is where I really start to worry about
it's you. It's a cross addiction.
I was worried about everything else you were fired drugs, with. But now you're a fitness fanatic and a marathon runner.
It's a cross addiction, dude.
I think marathon running is way worse for you.
Dude, the pain of it all.
So, like, when people say, is it another addiction? No, an addiction makes your life unmanageable and is painful, and you have a compulsion that you can't control. Trust me, I do not have a compulsion to jump out of bed and run.
Okay. Thank goodness.
Thank the Lord.
Trust me, it takes some energy and some will and some strength sometimes to put those tackies on. Yeah. But it does border on obsession, but I'll take it. Yeah, it's a healthy one.
Yeah, and it makes you feel good when you're doing it and you're winning and you're feeling strong and you're feeling positive.
It's free drugs, endorphins.
The endorphins, right? Mm-hmm. And you can get to the same level almost or not?
It's a different
level. Can you
recall
what it felt like to be on the drugs, and can you compare it with what it feels like to be pulsing those endorphins through your system because you've run a race?
I can compare it, but it's on a different level. Let's not bring sex into it. It's on a different level.
Wow.
The spiritual high you're getting, it can't be compared to the chemical high of drugs. So while the endorphins are working, finishing a race, finishing an Ironman, finishing that kind of high where you're crying crossing the finishing line is magical. And there's no magic in using drugs.
Does it for you, is it still a struggle every day, kind of fighting the darkness, as it were, and not going back there? Is it still a struggle?
I think over the years, resilience builds up. So recovery got me to where I am. Resilience is what keeps me here. And the resilience is because I have a whole set of tools. And I employ the tools. Sometimes I need them more than other days. But in general, it does get easier. But then certain things happen, certain stresses come, and then you can feel yourself wobbling. But I've been given a set of tools, and I use them every day. Check in with other addicts, help somebody else, talk about it, hand back the shame, say a prayer, write out one page of a journal.
Hand back the shame.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
There's a whole lot of shame that gets handed, that got dumped on me. That's not mine to take, not mine to carry. And when I hand back the shame, I literally wake up and say, I'm not what I thought people thought I was.
Yeah, what other people think of you is actually none of your business.
None of my business. And I need to remind myself every day.
Yeah. Well, this is a great story, and well done on the book. I am Costa, from Myth to Marathons, and a pleasure to spend some time with you and talk through your story. But I think for anybody who wants to hear more, go and buy the book. I mean, it's the kind of story that you really have to immerse yourself in. So congrats, dude.
Thank you.
And congrats on this victory, because it's nothing small. It's a big deal. And you are out there helping other people, and you are out there spreading the word, and that's tremendously important. There could be somebody who's right now in that hole that Pumi was describing earlier, and who could do with hearing this stuff.
Give the man an ad break. Where do you find the book? Is it freely available everywhere, or is it only at certain bookstores, select bookstores?
No, it's at 60 CNAs around the country.
Halala. Halala.
Bargain Books, Reader's Warehouse, Waterstones, and all exclusive books.
And if you can't find it there, can you get it online?
Yep. Takealot has it. Loot has it. And then it's also on Kindle, Nook, all of that stuff.
There's no excuse why.
If you're overseas, it is distributed on Amazon in hard copy.
Well done.
Well
done,
brother.
Costa Kanastavrakis. CliffCentral.com.